Right, I think we're recording. Firstly, I can't believe how quickly this semester has kind of happened. It's one minute we're schwitzing in August and now we're schwitzing in December. It's like ridiculous. But putting that to one side, quite amazing. Even today, it's supposed to be cooler, it's really quite warm. In terms of just... I'm going to make some general comments and then we'll go through the review sheet. Firstly, to say that this class has really been a hoot. Is that it? Can I say that? A hoot? It's probably an oldest word. It's probably been like the word groovy that nobody actually uses anymore, right? Nobody says groovy. I know, but guys like me grew up with this language. So it really has been a hoot. The reason why it's been a hoot is because I think we've got into a... sort of a level of understanding, at least I hope we have, of characters that most people just in a lifetime never really get to think about. Everybody knows about them, but they don't really know anything about them. I never forget, I gave a shiur once on Eliyahu HaNavi, this number of years ago, in shul on Shabbat, and there was a guy there from Brooklyn who came over to me and he said, "Rabbi, first time I ever heard a shiur on Eliyahu HaNavi." And I said, "You live in Brooklyn, you've got a million rabbis there, nobody speaks about Eliyahu HaNavi." He says, "No, they all talk about the halachic issues and whatever." But I said, "Eliyahu is such an important person, you know, you need to know something about him. We sing about him all the time, Eliyahu HaNavi, Eliyahu HaTishbi. You know, he's part of our liturgy. Every time we bench, you know, the Yivasa al-Basara Tavon." So it always amazes me that how little people do really study these things, and I think we've really made a massive effort to get to the heart of it. Which I'm grateful for. You know, I hope you've had a bit of a hoot, kick out of it. I've certainly had a kick out of it as well. In terms of exam protocol, I'm going to use that word even though I don't know what it means. You know how to do the exam. There's certain things I just want to mention. Firstly, please, I know this is towards the end of the exam period. If this is your last exam, the one that you're doing for me, then please do not fly to Israel 2 hours after the exam is over, as one young lady did about 10 years ago. Exam finished at 3, she had a flight to JFK at 5. El Al to Tel Aviv, very nice, but it did compromise a bit her ability to do the exam by about 2 hours. She had to, you know, you had to be there at 3 in order to check in. So after 20 minutes of total panic when she was trying to finish the exam, ran out of the room, managed to catch her flight, which again I thought was quite amazing. And as a consequence, unfortunately, instead of getting an A, which she should have done, she ended up with a C plus or something. It just was not worth it. If you're flying to Israel, get the next flight. Don't take the 5 o'clock, take the 10 o'clock or the 12 o'clock or whatever it is. You know, JFK or Newark or wherever you're flying from. Sounds an obvious thing, but believe me, it's for some it's not so obvious. In terms of the actual exam... there will be 6 questions on the paper, which you have to answer 5 out of 6. Every question, I'll take questions in a second. Every question is made up of 2 or 3 different sections. So what I do make very clear in the instruction is please remember to answer every question that you have to answer. There is no extra credit for answering 6 questions. 5 is 5. If you do the 6th question, you're basically wasting your own time, because, you know, as far as I'm concerned, it will get a line put through the work, and that will be it. I do not have time to start juggling around, which answer, the 6th answer will just be done away with. The booklets that you have, these wonderful blue or pink or whatever color they are this year, I don't know, wait and see. Don't hesitate to use those booklets as much as you have to. Please use the pages inside the booklet, but not the covers, except to write your name. And book 1, book 2, many booklets to use. One young lady, again, I kept this paper. She wrote her answer starting on the back cover and finished on the inside back cover and then finished it on the outside back cover. A whole answer to a question. It was a very interesting way of doing it, but did not endear her to me, because trying to read something on the cover is not always so easy. It's the wrong color, it's the wrong everything. So please don't use the covers for anything else but writing your name on the front. In terms of the booklets itself, you want to write on one side or on both sides, doesn't really matter. If you have one word to finish an essay, don't hesitate to use booklet number 2. And if necessary, booklet number 3. There are so many of these delightful little booklets floating around this place that I think they're always glad when, you know, we use them up. Sorry?
They say seat number.
It goes back to an ancient time in the history of Yeshiva University when things like that used to be the way it was done. But not anymore, thank goodness for that. I don't want to go through all of the rigmarole of you know, what the pre-preparations and all that sort of thing. Make sure you go to the bathroom before. And, you know, you're big ladies, you know exactly what... You know, you're strong, independent women, exactly. In which case, for goodness sake, it's not for me to tell you what to do. You're too... It'll be too condescending for me to go through that. On the other hand, I do want to make absolutely clear again that simple rules of answering questions, do not have to answer them in the order that they are asked. You want to do number 2, number 5, number 6, number 4, whatever it is, no problem about that. Also, I would say to you, please use a decent color of pen, right? Not the bright yellow one that I once had, or bright pink, I don't remember now, which I could only read under the covers late at night because it was fluorescent. It actually was shining in the dark. But when you tried to read it during the day, it really was very difficult. It didn't, you know, I had to go into a dark room to read it. It was absurd. So please use a regular blue, black, whatever. If you have to use a pencil, use a pencil. But for goodness sake, no pinks, purples, beige. Beige is not a good color. It's a nice color for your dress. Go to a wedding, but not for writing exam answers. Okay? I'm trying to bring a smile to some of your faces. I know it's exam time. Beige colour? I mean, nobody reacted. I don't know if anyone even knows what I'm talking about. It's just one of those... Exactly. Maybe some people would. I think somebody might Dafka. I know this is what's going to happen. All right. Seriously, in terms of the booklets that you... sorry, not the booklets, the text. Yeah, talk about that for a second. I'm very encouraging of you having a text with you and using it. Don't necessarily to write out chunks of Hebrew that you may not have the time or the inclination. You can write it in English. But, you know, like the significant phrase or the significant reference or whatever it may be. The only thing I cannot allow you is the red or pink or whatever color it is these days, the Judaica. I can't allow you to bring that in. But what you can bring in is a Mikraot Gedolot in Hebrew only, right? Or is that the Koran? That's good. Koran or JPS, but the Farshim in Hebrew only.
But what if it doesn't have a Farshim?
And if it doesn't have a Farshim, then that's absolutely fine. Hebrew English translation is perfectly good.
Oh,
okay?
It can have Hebrew
English translation. Yeah, I'm happy with that because I'm not here giving you a test on translations. I'm here to see what you think. And it's a different skill. So you can have... again, don't wait till you come to the final. If you have that type of book at home or you have it... Oh, the noises are crazy. If you have that type of book available, don't wait till the final. Just run around in the Beit Midrash upstairs trying to find it. You know, make sure you have it beforehand. Sorry? Well, sometimes it's just useful. I mean, I have no issue with you even doing a bit of kishkush, you know, sort of underlining certain things that you may want to include. If you know there's for sure going to be a question, there has to be a question on Elio, then there may be some salient phrases.
Oh, in other words, you can underline in the book?
Yeah, or you can highlight or whatever.
Also,
in the...
There can be things like jotted, like, not jotted down, like I'm saying, like, underlined.
Yeah, I have no problem with that because, again, you know, it's preparation for the final, which you then will incorporate whatever you've underlined, if it's relevant, into the question that you're answering. So I have no problem with that. What I can't allow is the red book, which gives you all the translations of the commentaries. That's a bit too much.
Are you asking us some of that commentary, or are you just going to ask us like an opinion and we get to add our own?
That's going to be something we'll talk about in a few minutes. All right, we'll actually come to that. What I would also say again is, as I said before, answer every section of every question. A lot of questions will be based on the storyline, so please make sure that is clear. If you have the red book or the pink book, at the beginning, it has an excellent summary of the storyline. So this is one of the big advantages of this book. Every chapter is summarized with headings and what's going on, and that's useful to read through to get clear in your mind the events. Saying that, I think it's also important that certain sections, obviously, we've looked at in more detail, so you know, you'll have not only the storyline in your mind, but a bit more analysis. I'm not expecting you to tell me who said what. I'm not here waiting to be told what Rashi says or what Ibn Ezra. It'd be nice if you did. And if you do remember which rabbi said it, that would be great. But that's not what I'm looking for. I'm looking for the idea, for the concept. If this was an MA course, it would be different. I would then be more harsh on, you know, if you don't tell me which rabbi said what, then, you know, that to me is what MA is about. But for an undergrad doing this type of course, I'm really interested in your ideas, your thinking. Some of the questions will be thinking questions, right? Not necessarily the whole question, but if you've got a three-part question, part C will say, on the basis of what we said just now, what do you think is, and then you'd have to give me your opinion. One of the things I want to try and encourage at the final is that it shouldn't just be churning out all of that information that I hope you have by then, if you don't have it already, but to actually use the information to be productive. See the exam as not just an hour and a half or an hour and 20 minutes or 2 hours of sitting, grinding your way through it, but maybe that it's also a chance, a bit of a learning experience. Okay, so I just want to make that clear. Okay, any questions on that? Because I think that's covered all of my nitty-gritty. Nitty-gritty, yes.
Do you mind just saying the part A, part B, and part C?
Sorry, again?
Do you mind just saying part A, part B, and part C for each question, like what you're...
Well, again, each question is different, but...
it's
not standard, it really isn't. But what sometimes happens if you feel, for instance, that you can do the whole question in one answer, right, then make that clear. You're answering A, B, and C in one paragraph. Okay? Because sometimes it can be done like that. But you've got to be careful that you are answering every part of every question. It's easier if it's part A, do a paragraph from part A, part B, and part C. Okay? And that's really the easiest way to do it.
How would you like suggest studying? Just go over notes and like...
Yeah. Initially, what we're going to do is obviously make sure the storyline is clear and then go over your notes in terms of the analysis that we've made. And this review sheet should be very... helpful, because this will focus you on the specific items of each topic. Okay, so I want that again to be clear. If your ears are open this afternoon, which I'm sure they are, you might even pick up some of the pointers about different questions that will be coming your way. I tolerate finals. I shouldn't go on record, but I really do believe this. You got to do it. It's one of those necessary evils. It's like the TSA. They got to take your belt because that's what they're supposed to do. Does it really stop anything or everything or what they're supposed to? You know, it's one of the things you just got to go through. Hate it. Love to get to the other end when I get off the plane, but it's what you have to go through. You know, you're in college. It's part of the process. Much more exciting for me is the learning process, the experience of learning, and that is, thank God, I think what has happened in this class. It's really good. Yeah. What perek is starting from chapter 12? 12, yeah. So this is where we get going on the review sheet. So you'll segue into the review sheet. Thank you so much. And here we go. Right, deep breath. Hold on to your whatever hats you're wearing. Some of you wore some cute hats during the semester. I've got to say. The Khamas hat's always good. So I just saying that in case you think I don't notice. I really do notice, which is great, which is absolutely great. Excellent thing. All right, I shouldn't have mentioned hats. My wife will kill me. Let's go, let's look at review for Sefer Melachim. Number one, Yeravam's basic error of judgment in making the Agalim. Oi, what a sad story. The kingdom is split between north and south, okay? And Yeravam is trying to make a, what did we call it? Not parallel Judaism, another word, pseudo-Judaism, something which looks like Jewish life, but is in a, its own, beats, what's the expression? it beats with it to its own drum, right? That's, I think, the expression. Meaning that, for instance, when he declares Sukkot, or the equivalent of Sukkot, instead of making it in the month of Tishrei, as it is in the south of Israel, in the kingdom of Judea, he makes it in the month of Cheshvan, the north of Israel. Everything is like on a parallel, but different time frame. And this is Yeravam's attempt to keep the north and south separate. Remember, we saw this right at the beginning. He also puts guards right across the land of Israel from east to west, or west to east, depending which way it went. And he was determined that there would be a spiritual center, two spiritual centers in the north, to supplant or to be there instead of Yerushalayim. So what does he do? He makes the north Bethel, which is in the center of the country, just above the line where the northern kingdom begins, and right in the north in the land of Dan, Eretz Dan. And there he has another place where you can go and worship, and he makes Agalim, Egal Zahar. And of course the big question is, hasn't he learned from Jewish history, and he knows his Jewish history, we're sure of that, that Egel Hazar was a disaster the first time round. So we explain two different approaches which try to justify what Yeravam was thinking. Not necessarily justify his action, but to understand what he was doing. Alright, we saw the Abarbanel. I'm mentioning the names, but again, I don't expect you to churn this out, but if you remember it, that's great. And we saw the Malbim. What does the Abarbanel say? Right? Why was the ox or the cow or whatever so significant for Yeravam? What tribe did Yeravam come from? Right? Somebody help me out here. The tribe of? You got 1 to 12 chances, yes? Of? Yosef. Excellent. He's a man of Joseph. Good stuff. And of course, what is the significance of the eagle, the shor, the bull, the ox, etc.? Excuse me. And the rabbis explained, the Abarbanel explains, that this was the symbol of the tribe. Okay, the Bechor Shoro Hadar Lo. Pasuk we're going to read next week, next Shabbat. It's the, I think it's next Shabbat. The description of the glory of Yosef is to be compared to the Bechor Shor, to the ox, the firstborn of the litter, the strongest of the oxes of a particular group of oxen, and that is Yosef's image, as it were, this tremendous source of strength. And of course, for Yeravam, making that image was not, God forbid, making an Egel Zaham, golden calf, which was a disaster from the days going back to Moshe Rabbeinu, but this was emphasizing the strength, the power of the tribe of Yosef, which again, I think makes sense. What did the Malbim say? Something about Egypt. Somebody remind me, because I'm sure you'll remember. Where did Yeravam get these ideas of Agalim? Two oxen. So the image of the two oxes. Remember what we said? He was, remember.
Didn't he live there?
Yeah, he lived there. Great.
Like a holiday.
Excellent. They are there to this day, and it's documented, that in Egypt they would have a special, and what the word is, celebration, a holiday, which was based on the worship of the ox. There were two towns, one was called Heliopolis and one was called Memphis. Okay? And without any references to the modern day, I know there's a Heliopolis in America, there probably is somewhere, who knows? Certainly is a Memphis. But the reality of it is that these were practices which Yeravam had seen in Egypt. And what he decided to do was to take those practices and bring them to Eretz Israel in the attempt of focusing the people, even the more religious ones. He would say to the people that, listen, when you went to the Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim and you knew there was a Holy of Holies, in that Holy of Holies there were kruvim, there were images, statues, whatever they were. So I'm not doing anything else but providing you with, let's say, a substitute for kruvim, they're called agalim. And of course, what happened was that initially this was an attempt by Yeravam to get the people, even the more observant people, the more traditional Jews at that time, to say, well, I'm not going to go down to Jerusalem. He stopped them going anyway because he had guards. But putting that to one side, he said that I want the people to worship here because this will give us the spiritual basis of creating our new kingdom of Israel. Okay, and this is exactly what he did. Now, of course, there's a basic error. And the basic error is that whichever way you look at it, it leads automatically in the Middle East of those days to the very serious problem of Avodah Zarah. Let's do time out on Avodah Zarah for 2 minutes, because we spoke about this quite recently. Avodah Zarah, did it make sense or did it not make sense? It made sense. Why? Why did Avodah Zarah? Yes, it was about
agriculture.
Excellent. All of the focus of idolatry was, or much of the focus, was to create a sense of, how should we say, I called it plan B. There's plan A. Plan A, you okay?
Yeah, you're right. I'm so sorry.
No problem. Plan A was obviously relying on God, bitachon, etc., trust in Hashem. Plan B would be to say, well, if God is angry with us, or God, we're not quite connected to God the way we should be, let's make sure we get our crops and we get our food grown through the forces of nature. Now, the force of nature can be something which is very natural, right, using the term, or it can be something which has a combination of natural and supernatural. And the whole idea of the idolatrous practice was to harness that energy which is in the world revolving around nature, which in itself, the claim was that it was of a supernatural quality. It could ensure that you worshipped, you did the service of the Asherah and the service of the Baal and all these things. These are all very fertility minded. Most of the stuff was revolving around that, because it's basic survival problem. If you haven't got the food, you're going to die. So you needed to make sure the food came about. And this was something which came from the non-Jewish world, who divorced themselves from God. They recognized the God of Israel, but they argued the God of Israel is up there, Shemayim, and not really involved with this world. And if we want to make sure that we are fed and we survive the trials of this world, we have to connect to a different force called Avodah Zarah, foreign worship. And of course, for the Jews, this was totally forbidden because it was detracting from their connection to God. It was saying almost that God is unable to do this, the other forces can do this instead. Everything about it is wrong. And although it made perfect sense, of course it was wrong, and it became overwhelming. As we mentioned, there's a story in the Talmud of a certain rabbi who was making a very serious complaint about the kings of Israel serving idolatry, and one of the kings comes to him in a dream, I think it was King Manasseh, and he says to this rabbi, "Rabbi, if you'd been living in my generation, you would have been the first one to run to do idolatry. You would have been quicker than anybody else, because you have no idea the feeling, the Yetzirah, the sense of attraction to that particular style of worship. It was overwhelming." And of course, the tradition is, as we mentioned, that the Second Temple, beginning of the Second Temple, the men of the Great Assembly, Anshei Knesset Gedolah, the last of the prophets and the first of the rabbinic gentlemen, Ezra and beyond, they prayed to God to take away this desire, and it went. And it says a fire went up to heaven, a dramatic description in the Gemara, and it's gone. And of course, the problem is that when, as we said, with the world in balance, as it is, between good and evil, if something very evil goes away, something very good disappears at the same time, and that of course seems to be the element of prophecy. By the time you get to the period of the Second Temple, prophecy is not around. It's much more about tradition, Torah Shebaal Peh. It's about the rabbi-student relationship. Initially, it starts off pairs of rabbis, then it becomes schools of rabbis, Beit Shammai, Beit Hillel, etc. All of that develops during the Second Temple period, and it wasn't around in the First Temple period. So idolatry was a feature of particularly the northern kingdom of Israel, and it was very serious. The Torah legislates 36 times not to worship idols. 36 times. It's a lot. So the idea of doing this was really very, very serious. Any questions? Any comments? I'm pretty sure we've covered that, and just hopefully this is not discovering new material. Number two. And again, we're still dealing with the Ravam. This sort of moves from chapter 12 to chapter 13. His character and the discussion with King David. What do we say about that? Excuse me. They were walking where? It's again a midrashic comment, but it's so revealing. What was going on? Where were they having a little straw? God on, with David on one side and Yeravam on the other side. Gave you a handout about this. Yes, Brahm. Gan Eden, right? Everyday occurrence, as you can imagine. I'm not sure what it's all about, but that's what the rabbis say. And they were wandering around in the Garden of Eden, and God says to Yeravam, now is the time to repair. You'll be able to walk with me and David. And Yeravam says, provided that, finish the sentence. Yep. Who's going first? Yeravam. How unbelievable. He considers himself more important than David. And of course, at that point, we really do understand what Yeravam is really about. It's about his own ego, his own importance, his own sense of, I am it. I am the person. Again, a bit like certain gentlemen who are trying to become president of the United States. It always comes back to that. Or sometimes comes back to that. So it's one of those situations. The rabbis are revealing to us the inner workings of his mind. He was so convinced that he was it. He'd been given, by the way, if you just look back at chapter 11, the end, he was given a blessing that had he followed the Torah, the command of God, the northern kingdom would have been very successful. He was given a bracha by one of the Nevi'im at that time, one of the prophets, Achia Shiloni, and Yeravam was totally convinced, because essentially of his own failings in his character, that there was nothing greater than him in the Jewish world, and this is why he did what he did, went on his own way. Very, very interesting stories. Remember the story with his arm stretched out and he couldn't bring it back again. And the whole thing with the prophet, the false prophet, and the real prophet, and everything that's going on over there. All of that particular story, all again, happening in the north of Israel, where these were very few and far between, these types of people, if they were genuine, close to God. They weren't really available in the north of Israel, and all of the consequences of the way the society went down, and created these problems. That's number two. Number three, we just spoke about the ideas of idolatry, about survival of everybody. It's a survival mechanism. So it did make sense, even though it was incredibly against the laws of Torah. I do mention from time to time when I think about it, then if I mention it in class, that in London you can go and visit the British Museum. Any of you are going to be in England, it's a great visit to make. And class trip would be very nice, but not so easy to do that, sort of to get it organized, but it would be a nice thought. What I would say is that sometimes there are trips. There's usually a literature group that goes. They've done that the last couple of years. So they did that like 2 or 3 years ago, so it was good. The British Museum has a lot of Jewish interest, and a lot of these basic idols have been found in the excavations that they've been doing. And the guy who took us around, this rabbi in London who does these trips, tours of the British Museum, he made it very clear. He says that when you read the description next to the exhibit of what it actually says, you shouldn't bow forward. He says, because by bowing forward to read the description, you would be possibly seen as bowing towards the idol, which is not the thing to do. So he says, best thing to do is to slant, like you do on Pesach, to lean to the left or to lean to the right. So they have this very strange group of people walking around the museum who come up to every exhibit and start looking as if they're all drunk because they're all leaning to the right or leaning to the left. It was very entertaining at the time. They do have an amazing exhibit there of King Yehu. King Yehu is someone that we do mention very much in passing in Malachim Aleph. And he points out that on this inscription, which was dated back to the original days, they used to do images of the kings being greeted by other kings. It's got King Yehu, the Jewish king, bringing a tribute to the king of, Assyria. And you can see Yehu's tzitzis. You can actually see the strings of his tzitzis on the the inscription on the exhibit. It's quite amazing, quite interesting, and again, you know, it sort of makes the whole thing a bit more meaningful when you look for that type of detail. So that's basically, again, so as I said, you know, there are issues of idolatry possibly even to this very day, but the actual Yetzer Hara, the desire to go and worship idols, that's gone, certainly from the Jewish one. If everybody else wants to go and do it, then, you know, they're free to do whatever they want, but for Jews there is no great desire to do this. Number four, why are so many more kings in the north than in the south? We did mention this in one of our lessons. Look at that list. I gave you a whole list. There's like 20 kings of the north by the time the whole kingdom is finished. And in total, in the south, there are only like 10 or 11, something like that. So there seems to be almost double the number of kings in the north. Tremendous amount of upheaval, right? People getting bumped off every Monday and Thursday, as they say. Guys were killed after 7 days. What is going on? Why is the northern kingdom so much more full of changeover of kingship? I mean, the answer is kind of obvious. Is it obvious? Somebody help me out here. Why so many more kings in the north than in the south? What was the traditions that they were following? Kind of follows on. Sorry? Yeah. Starting off with Yeravam, and therefore, in the north, what was the tradition? Was it...
Judaism.
Sorry? The pseudo-Judaism. That was not following in the prescription of Torah, mitzvot, etc. And as a consequence, that led to upheaval on upheaval of kingship. Kings were not stable in the north because they were just not following the requirements of being a king. The Jewish king was told, as David was told, Shlomo was told, even Yeravam was told, if you follow the script, you'll be fine. If you keep the mitzvot and you lead the people in the correct path, everything will be fine. And the kings in the north just didn't do that. Alright, as far as they were concerned, each one was a little bit worse than the one before. Okay, and this is what the way they're described. Yeah.
Except for Omri.
Except Omri is an interesting discussion. I didn't put him down. I do have Omri and Achav for the land and the people. Yeah, we'll come to him in a minute. That's number five, number six. And he's an interesting guy. More kings in the north than in the south. So basically, if you get such a question like that, you need to talk a bit about the different approach. The south remained much more traditional, land of Judea, revolving around Yerushalayim, the dynasty of King David. They held on. Those kings lasted a very long time. Yehoshaphat, Asa. These were very long-standing kings. And in the main, they observed the traditions of Israel going back to Moshe Rabbeinu. So the only thing where they seemed to have failed was what is called the Bamot. The Bamam is this concept of having your private altar in the backyard.
That was north or south?
Sorry? They're in both, but even in the south. And these were not removed. The kings of the south failed to remove this particular aspect of Jewish life, non-Jewish life, I suppose you would call it, and as a consequence, they did not succeed 100%. There was one moment, according to what we read, when the kingdom of the north and south could have come together again at a certain point, and it never happened during the reign of King Asa. Asa, I think, was Shlomo's great-grandson, something like that. And he didn't manage to pull it off because they hadn't quite got rid of some of the trappings of idolatry which was creeping into the south of Israel. Alright, so again, I think that's just important to mention and to think about when you're preparing for the final. Okay, without giving away too much. Say no more, say no more. Number five, civil war. Sefer Melachim, Divrei Yamim. Divrei Yamim, I don't know if we saw the text, but it basically just gives you a bit more detail. I think we actually did read it through. What is the issue of civil war? What exactly happens between the north of Israel and the south of Israel? They start having these horrendous battles. What sort of numbers are we talking about? Just give me some... Sorry? 100,000 is a very conservative, low estimate. We're talking more in the millions. We're talking about 800,000 soldiers, I think, from the south, it's either one or the other. I think it's 800,000 in the north, 500,000 in the south. 1.3 million Jews who are involved in what is essentially a civil war between the two parts of Israel. How tragic is all this? And this is, again, what goes on in Sefer Melachim. It's alluded to, not explained in great detail, But when you read Divrei Yamim, if you look in your notes, I think we did go through a bit of that, you'll see that the wars there are spelled out in great detail, also in terms of the names of the kings that took over one after the other, exactly how they sometimes they did come together, but in most situations they were at loggerheads. So you have Yeravam, who's eventually killed by the son of Rechavam. Rechavam is Shlomo's son. The son of Rechavam kills Yeravam in one of these battles, right? And it says there were literally thousands upon thousands of people. Just one comment about Rechavam, which I haven't put on the page. Remember, he was given a choice between listening to the Yeladim or to the Zakenim, the elders or to the young Yeladim. It says children, but it means the young guys. And what did he do? What was his mistake? He listened to Yeladim. He decided that they said to him, people are complaining about Shlomo's taxation. You know what you're going to do? Instead of making it easier for them, you make it harder for them. You give them more taxation because that means that you're in charge. Not understanding that that was not the way to win friends or influence them or do anything, but alienate the population. So remember that whole discussion at the beginning. Rechavam makes a very big error of judgment, and as a consequence, the world turns against him. And that's why they move away and create their new country in the north of Israel. So it revolves initially around the issues of taxation. Seems to always be something to do with money. Number six, and we're getting there. Omri and Achav for the land and the people. What did we say about Omri? This is over to Eliza, because there's a very nice thing that we said. What was so unique about Omri that we had to point it out? He was a bad guy. He was an idolater. Right, his son Achav really wasn't much better. They followed in the way of Yeravam. But what was special about Omri, which was unique?
He bought the Shomron or Shemer.
Excellent. He developed the city now known as Samaria, called Samaria. I mean, now we know the area is known as Shomron, but at that time it was the capital city of the north of Israel. And there's no question about it that to a certain extent there is a certain level of recognition of Korasatov. There's recognition of doing good. Because Omri was responsible for building a new city in Eretz Israel. We spoke a little bit about Rav Kook, and we spoke about Rav Kook's relationship to the early pioneers in Israel, people who came to build the land. They were communists and Zionists and every ist that you can imagine, but not many of them were religious. But for Rav Kook, they were still important because for him, this was their mitzvah to develop and build the land of Israel. And therefore, in the tradition of Omri, who did not have many merits, no question about that, the merit that he did have was the fact that he developed this town, this city, and put it on the map. The city of Shomron, Samaria. Okay? Achav, we also said, for the land and for the people. How does Achav show himself for the people? Oh, that jumps a bit to the end of the Sefer.
He went to the war.
Excellent. What happened to him in the war? The final war. There were three wars.
Oh. Bleeding out in the lake, whatever, with the
carriage. Pretty nasty, yes.
And then he still stays there until...
And he stands there till the war is over, even though he knows that he's dying, should be getting into a hospital, and he isn't, because he's there for the people, for Am Yisrael. A very special man. The Gemara says so beautifully, it says that the generation of Achav, in a way, was a greater generation than other generations, because although they worshipped idols, that was the downside, they did not tell stories about each other, which it says in the generation of David, they were involved in Lashon Hara. Okay? Lashon Hara is something which, again, has always been a very negative behavior amongst the Jewish people. Somebody once put it to me, I must have told you this, that two people were saying, talking about Lashon Hara. So one says to the other, I never repeat Lashon Hara, I only say it once. So it's a trick of the English language, that really something to think about. Okay, so that's Omri and that's Achav, and again we're going to talk a bit more about Achav in a few minutes. Well, let's talk about him now. What was the downside of Achav? What was the upside of Achav? What was Achav's philosophy on life? You know, King Ahab. Sorry? Great. But how could he justify his view? What was his view about the way the world functioned? Because clearly
the world, and then you leave it alone, and then the
let you get on with it. And he had this sense of everybody is connected, a kind of what we would have called in the 1960s the brotherhood of man. Alright? Universal brother. Which of course meant that people like Jezebel, Izebel, would have been very possible for him to marry, as he did, because he saw this as following that particular concept. Alright? Everybody were all under the influence in this world of being sort of one big family of humanity, and therefore there's no problem with me as a Jew, Jewish king, marrying the princess from somewhere up north. She came from Lebanon. Sorry?
Very
Kabbish. Very? Kabbish. What is that? It's the sort of thing that, you know, if you were around in Woodstock in 1969, you would have heard it in Woodstock in 1969. I sort of remember growing up with some of those things. Very strange. The concept, therefore, is that, again, Achav is certainly there for the people, he's there for the land, but he's not a good role model because he has compromised some of the most basic issues of Jewish life. What do we find is his most prized possession? Sefer Torah. But what has he done to the Sefer Torah? Takes out Hashem's name. So there's something very weird about this. He recognizes that this is a holy book, but he doesn't want the name of God to be in the book because of his idolatrous connections. So every time it says Shem Hashem, he just took a scissor or whatever and just removed it from the Sefer Torah, which is weird. Okay, very strange. For us, it's, I don't know, I guess there probably are Jews like this around, humanistic, you know, more inclined to sort of see the world in this way, and sort of trying to move away from God, from that type of view of the world, but it's tough. Elijah and Pinchas, the Rolbag's analysis. This is chapter, we're getting to chapter 17 at the beginning. So what does the Rolbag argue, even though he's a rationalist?
They seem
to be handing over the baton, if that's the expression to use, one to the other, even though they seem to have different roots. But the suggestion is that they are one and the same. Why did it become so important that Eliyahu comes at the end of days to announce Mashiach, if we are now saying that he is Pinchas? Where was Pinchas at the beginning, which Eliyahu can talk about at the end, if you see what I mean? He was there to give me the Torah. So if Eliyahu comes at the end of days, and the Gemara says so many questions you leave till Eliyahu comes along, the reason why it's Eliyahu is because, according to this tradition, he was around at the beginning. He heard the definitive word of God about all these different laws, and when it comes to the end of days, he will come along again, according to tradition, and sort us out. He will tell us what we were doing, this is right, this is wrong, hopefully put us on a bit more of a, you know, sort of good line than some of the stuff that I have to say goes on today, which blows my mind. The reality of Elijah and Pinchas, this is really, really important. The idea of continuation. Many of the expressions, and again, if you look at your notes, we did highlight the use of Chaim v'Shalom, various things that were words that were used, Brit Shalom, etc., which were used with Pinchas, are used with Eliyahu. Okay, so this idea, Pinchas never died, Eliyahu never died. Alright, even though we read last lesson that he goes up in the chariot of fire, come back in about three or four, great exit. The three or four chapters later, that says there is a king, again, Yehoshaphat, if I'm not mistaken, who receives Michtav Me'Eliyahu. He receives a letter from Elijah. And there's no suggestion that Eliyahu wrote it before he was taken away by God. He's around. He comes back again. Eliyahu is not going to depart, but Eliyahu is in the process of trying to become, I suppose, whatever the word is, humanized as much as he can. That was what Eliyahu was trying to do all through his life, with not very much success. Eliyahu was a very tense mix of human elements and divine elements, right? The fire and the air was very divine. It took him onto flights of literally, he could fly away, he was on the top of a mountain, whatever it was, and you had the water and the earth, which would bring Eliyahu down to to earth, to ground. And this combination of elements in Eliyahu's DNA, if you want to call it that, was not a happy combination. Eliyahu was determined to break off the mortal coil as much as he could, become more connected to God, more spiritual, and he has problems with that. And as he goes through, he's trying to... God is saying to him, Eliyahu, you're here in the world for a purpose. Malacho po Eliyahu, you're here to create a presence, a spiritual presence in this world. And of course, the interesting thing is, Eliyahu is functioning in the north. He's not functioning in the south. So Eliyahu's job is clearly to make things happen. What did we say about the food that he's being fed? Remember what we commented, that it came from whose kitchen? It came from Ezeba, from Achav's kitchen. So again, there is this sense, even with Achav, as much as he had a kind of philosophical issue with the presence of God in this world, when it came to certain basic Jewish practices, he was relied upon by Eliyahu. Okay, the kitchen was kosher. That is quite an interesting thought, if you think about it. There's a Gemara, you've got a whole piece of Talmud on that basis. Number 8, and we're getting there. Yes. Correct. He goes because he's desperate. He feels he's done his as much as he can do. And what Hashem is saying to him, look, come back. Let's have you back in camp base or whatever, HQ, headquarters, and we're going to reformat you to send you back again. And it's very interesting. It's a bit to me like what happens, they have the Chabad has this like 3,000 rabbi meeting that they have normally after the Chagim. 3,000 beards. There's more beard per square inch in that group than you've ever seen in your life. And it's quite amazing. It's absolutely amazing. And these guys are fantastic guys, and they're all over the world. But they come back to the mothership, right? Sort of Star Trek. And they're back into that particular situation of chizuk. They get together, they talk about their problems, talk about their issues. They have a fantastic dinner with, they all attend some place in New York, I don't know where it is. And it is really something to behold. Okay? And again, the idea of coming back to the source and being infused with the spirit all over again, which is what seemingly is happening to Eliyahu over and over again. The events of Mount Carmel, how is it allowed? Moshe compared to Eliyahu, we did speak a little bit about Moshe's, the comparison, 40 days without food, going to Mount Sinai, which is what Eliyahu does and what Moshe did. How is it allowed? What was the problem with Mount Carmel?
Oh, I know.
Yeah. Excellent. Correct. So the answer is that this is what is called, according to some people, Hora'at Sha'ah. Hora'at Sha'ah means it's absolutely allowed for the purposes. Once, it's a one-off, one-shot deal. Or you can say another concept which is called Avera Lishma. Avera Lishma means that it's a sin, but it's being done. Lishma here means for the sake of the Jewish people. There are certain events in Jewish history where a sin was performed for the sake of the Jewish people. The classic example is, for instance, Esther, right? Avera Lishma, a sin for the sake of the Jewish people. Esther, after the story of Purim, remains married to Ahasuerus. Pretty shocking development there. Not really expected. You would think she goes back to Mordechai and that's the end of the story. No. She stays with Ahasuerus, and even worse, or seemingly worse, they have a child together. And the child becomes Darius II, the great leader of Persia, who eventually allows the Jewish people, he's Jewish, right? He allows the Jewish people to go and rebuild, finally finish the project of rebuilding the second temple. So there's no question that there is a purpose to that, but at the time when Esther stays with Ahasuerus, everybody might have been saying, how is she, the nice Jewish girl, staying with this awful king? The answer is, Avera Lishma. It's not something you can just go along and say, well, I'm doing this sin. I'm having this cheeseburger for the sake of the Jewish people. That's not really the way it works. When you're doing an Avera Lishma, it's usually for the sake of saving the Jews. Many cases, like Yael, that story with Sisera, also is where she's committing a sin. Some say she seduces him in the tent. But again, it's for the purposes of killing the enemy general who is going against the Jewish people. And she is doing Avera, a sin, Lishma, for the sake of God. Okay, for the sake of the people. So this is again another explanation of how Carmel was allowed, Mount Carmel it was doing a sin, even though it was outside the temple, they were burning, offering a sacrifice, but for the sake of Hashem, for the sake of the Jewish people. When the people saw it, Hashem Olakim, Hashem Olakim, even though they saw it, they did not change. Change is something which doesn't happen overnight. Change is something which is very gradual. And of course, Elio expected things to change. It doesn't. And Elio gets tremendously distraught. And he goes back to Mount Sinai. He goes back to God. And he wants to be taken away. And Hashem shows him the earthquake. The earth is trembling. And the fire and everything else. And he says in the end of the day, it's called Mamad Daka. Elio, you have to appreciate that. You know, you're in this world. It's not about making the big events. It's not about making the earth tremble. It's not about making the earth move, as they say. It's about Kol Dmamat Daka, a small voice, getting that message across to the world, ideally to Am Yisrael. And of course, Elion is learning. He's learning from his life experience how to project that idea into Jewish life. And of course, he becomes the savior over and over again of individual Jews. He's now got to connect, not to do, as they say, the big stuff. He's connecting on a one-to-one basis with every Jew who has ever existed. He comes to your Seder, he comes to your Brit. He is there in order to be part of the history, the future of Am Yisrael. Quite amazing. So that's again Moshe and Eliyahu. A lot of comparisons in terms of the way they behaved. Again, you can argue even in death. Moshe has a very mysterious death, goes to a place where nobody sees him and he dies. Bineshika has never been found. And Eliyahu also goes to the Yarden, we saw that, and whoosh, next thing you know, he is a puff of smoke, or words to that equivalent. We're nearly done. Number 9, King Achav with the story of Navot. As we said, that even though Achav felt justified in trying to get the vineyard, Navot said no. So the question, of course, is, what's going on over here? Why did Navot say no? Was Navot justified in saying no? So what did we say? Number of answers. Navot did not want to sell it to Achav because, what was Achav going to use it? Vodah Zorah. Or because it was land which was owned by Navot's family. It was ancestral land. Can't give that away. Alright? And we said a few things. Look in your notes. So there's a few concepts that we said. And as a consequence, we saw that Achav was just unable to argue the point. He disappears. What does Izebel do, this awful woman? She takes care of business. She basically puts Navot into a dangerous situation. Navot is put to death. In this particular situation, Eliyahu appears and says to Achav, Achav, you allowed a terrible thing to happen. And Achav is mortified. He doesn't realize, I think, at this point, or now he realizes, how evil his wife really is, if he didn't know this beforehand. And we say that, in fact, as a result, the situation of Achav seems to be ready for a bit of tshuva. Okay? He seems to become very inactive, he becomes very morose, and it's only Izebel seems to pull him out of it. But there is a sense that Achav is realizing he's got to do something before he dies in order to bring himself a bit closer to the God of Israel. And this, of course, links what we said before. When it comes to the wars, the first two wars that he has, in fact, he wins. But the third war is particularly significant because he stands, even though he's mortally wounded, he stands with the soldiers, with the chariot, until the war is won for the third time. He's giving his life for Am Yisrael, and that's an incredible thing. And over in Anasis Elio, his life and reputation, his epiphany. The epiphany is not the word that we use, but it's a similar idea in chapter 19. Elio realizes that, you know what, his life for him was being wasted, because again, he saw things in such a black and white circumstance. Everything was clear to him as being either for or against. It was, you know, either the holy or unholy, but he couldn't understand that within unholy there can be some holy, what they call in Hasidic writings, called nitzotzot, holy sparks. And these holy sparks come in and they can influence even the most unholy of situations. And this is what Elio has to come to terms with. This is what he has to learn throughout the rest of history. His job, therefore, is to carry the tradition from Mount Sinai through to the Messianic days, and at the same time to connect to every Jew to bring that sense of holiness into situations where he arrives, be it the Seder, be it the Brit, be it every Motzoi Shabbat. Many people sing the Eliyahu HaNavi song. The Sephardi friends that I have seem to sing Eliyahu all the time, whenever they can. And this is what it is. It's beautiful. And, you know, it's very much part of the Jewish tradition to this very day. The legends of Eliyahu, him coming to help us in circumstances when we're in trouble, etc., etc. The demise of Eliyahu, this is the thing that we finally finished. The connection with fire, the angel or man. Make up your mind what he was. A man who had angelic tendency, or an angel who had, I was going to say man-ic tendency, but that's probably a bad way to describe it. He had male, human tendencies, right? And as a consequence of this combination between man and angel, just sort of again say a bit more about the life of Eliyahu. And finally, a work in progress, as we said before, guardian of the oral law, going back to the earliest tradition that we have of him being connected to Pinchas and what it means. Okay, so I think putting all that kind of together, we sort of give a a focus here on the semester that we've seen. Essentially, it's got two parts to it. It's got the Northern Kingdom and the way that it kind of was not functioning the way it should have done. And then Eliyahu and what he represented, not just in his generation, not just in his geographical location, but what he represents for the Jewish people then and forevermore. Okay, Eliyahu is still around. Yivasalonu b'sarot tovot, yeshuot v'nechamot. It's beautiful tefillah, which we say the whole time. Eliyahu is the one who's going to come back. How will we recognize him? Right? As we said, he looks a bit like Kramer. He's got this strange hairdo, coat, which is like, you know, two sizes too big, 10 sizes too big, a big belt. So again, if you see some guy, I suppose in New York you see them every day, all these guys running around like that, but it may be Eliyahu HaNavi. You know, when he comes back, we'll all know who he is. Quite exciting. Any comments, any questions? I sort of rolled my way through all of this material. And again, read your notes, read the information. I think we've really got a handle on Eliyahu. It's kind of exciting. There will be a focus on Eliyahu, but different aspects. You know, for instance, the story we haven't spoken about here, but one of the famous stories of the child that he brings back to life, it turns out to be Yonah Navi. Why does Yonah become so reluctant later on to do what God asked him to do? Because, you know, in the end of the day, his life experience was, sort of miraculous that he's still alive. So God says to him, go and start giving Musa to other people. He doesn't feel capable of doing that. You know, sort of think about what we said with Yonah, that particular story, which is interesting.
In two questions, we mentioned similar things.
It is a similar thing. So we've done a lot on Eliyahu, but obviously there will be questions focusing on specific aspects of Eliyahu's life. Okay.
The overall analysis and a work in progress kind of seem like the same question.
Same thing, yeah. The work in progress is more about what Eliyahu has become after the stories have ended. This work in progress, meaning that once he's gone back to Shemayim, what is the tradition of Eliyahu Navi to this very day? That's what I mean by work in progress, as opposed to the analysis, which is when he was still around. His wife, what is her situation? We spoke about that. It was a bit of an entertaining little item. No, it's very... I saw the article that was written by a great Rosh Hashiva about 50, 60 years ago. He was killed in the war. He read it before the war, and it's very halachic. It's not easy to write about, because what the status of Mrs. Eliyahu is very challenging.
It's the status of the mitzvah after you get married.
Yeah, yeah, and it's kind of fascinating what he tries to say, but he does couch it in much too heavy halachic terms, and I'd like to see it more as a kind of analysis of her situation, you know, sort of in terms of a guna and what. Is she really a guna or not a guna? It's very, very difficult to say. If he's coming back, then she's clearly not a guna. But I don't want to go into that. That's not a happy topic to talk about. The final comment, which again, I just want to reiterate how it really has been a joy to sort of come into this. I know it's late. It's late on a Thursday. It's late on a Tuesday. But they've been fun. And again, if you do sort of have the the time slot to come back and sort of join me again, I'd be more than delighted to carry on the Ariel is already Ariel has exhausted every course that I've done. I think every single one. I think you get a special prize for that. Not sure what it is. A sticker, yeah. A couple of stickers. But seriously, I look forward to seeing everybody. Don't be late for the final. Get your acts together on that particular...
What time is the final?
1 till 3. 1 till 3. I think it's 1 till 3. Sorry? January 5th, something like that. All right, everybody. Have a wonderful Shabbat. Shabbat Shalom.